Iran says it's ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild Beirut's port that was destroyed by a massive blast last year. Moscow says NATO's expulsion of eight members of the Russian mission to the military alliance will have an adverse effect on their ties. And according to a UN report, the Security Council sanctions against North Korea have worsened the country's humanitarian situation. Hi, everybody. From Tehran, I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. The Iranian foreign minister says that his country is ready to help Lebanon overcome its economic crisis. In a news conference in Beirut, Hossein Amin Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild the Beirut port that was destroyed in a huge explosion last year. He was speaking after talks with top Lebanese officials, including President Michel Aoun and Parliament Speaker Nabih Berri. In his meeting with President Aoun, Iranian foreign minister stressed Tehran's support for Lebanon's independence, sovereignty, and territorial integrity. President Aoun also said that Lebanon supports efforts aimed at creating convergence among regional states. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Salo, says the Lebanese officials have welcomed the expansion of ties with Iran, particularly as regards resolving fuel and electricity shortages in that country.
The Iranian foreign minister also stressed once more Iran's readiness to assist Lebanon in all issues, and the fact that the initiative or the proposal to build two power stations, which could give around 1,000 megawatts a day, something that Lebanon is in dire need of, and no other side or no other country has presented that such a proposal that could be done with the Lebanese government paying in the local currency, which would be very much helpful because it would be built based on work that would be done in Lebanon, so therefore it would be done through Lebanese currency, which would be very significant for the country, would not have to bring in more U.S. dollars, would not affect the current crisis, would actually help uplift the current situation. Now we see with Lebanon with the power cuts that are basically paralyzing the entire country. And despite the fact that we do have Iranian fuel coming in, assisting the general or private motors, and of course some institutions and charity organizations and hospitals and so on, still we do have a major crisis when it comes to providing electricity for the entire country.
From Beirut, I'm now joined by Jamal Wakim, Professor of International Relations with the Lebanese University. Good to have you with us, Professor Wakim. So let's hear your opinion regarding Iran-Lebanon ties, in particular this latest Iranian offer to embark on some development project to help Lebanese.
Well, I think that the Iranian proposal is a serious one, and I believe that Iran could help on the economic level, especially that its economic offers are not bound politically the way the Western offers are for Lebanon. However, I don't see a big chance for these proposals to be accepted by the Lebanese government, because too bad, the Lebanese government is much influenced by the West. Its members, most of its members, except for Hezbollah members, are affiliated with the West and are representatives of Western capital. So that's why I believe that they would do their best in order to hinder these proposals and not accept them. And they have done the same with other proposals coming from Russia and even from China. So too bad. If these proposals are to be accepted, I believe that our only chance is that they pass through Hezbollah.
Okay, Professor Wakim, if these people who are opposed to assistance from Iran or from Russia, as you mentioned, do they have their own solutions? Have they done anything to help the country?
Too bad, no, because they have been this class, actually, have been ruling for the past 40 or 50 years. And it was during the reign of this political class, regardless of the names, but most of the names are stable, at least since the mid-80s. We have our standard of living deteriorated, our economy deteriorated, and we had chronic problems. And they don't have a vision for the state, for the country, what role this country would have. And they are much immersed in their handlings, in their petty interests and short-term interests, to the extent of not finding national solutions for our national problems, including electricity, debt, building infrastructure, etc. So I believe that our best chance is for these proposals to pass the way Iranian oil passed to Lebanon through Hezbollah, and to widen actually the scope of alliances between the Eurasian powers, Iran, Russia, and China, with alternative elites in Lebanon, because we cannot count on the elite that was established since the mid-19th century onward, and that was linked, integrally linked to French capital and then Anglo-Saxon capital. So we cannot count on Mikati, we cannot count on the Hariris, we cannot count, for example, even on some allies of Hezbollah in the government, because they are all affiliated with Western capital.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Jamal Vakin, Professor of International Relations at Lebanese University. Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has released footage showing Iranian Navy vessels tracking a U.S. warship. The footage displays several IRGC speedboats chasing a U.S. warship in Iran's southern waters. The Islamic Republic has repeatedly warned against any act of aggression, pledging to defend its territorial integrity and the country's borders. In 2016, IRGC vessels seized two U.S. command boats after they entered Iran's territorial waters. The Yemeni army says it's downed a spy drone belonging to the Saudi-led military coalition over the Jazan region. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said that the Yemeni air defenses shot down the U.S.-made aircraft while it was carrying out hostile missions in that area. The general said that the footage of the wreckage will be broadcast soon. Saudi Arabia launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. It's killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others. Palestinians have denounced an Israeli court decision to grant Jewish worshippers the right to perform prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry says it will exert all efforts to challenge the decision. The Hamas resistance movement also decried the ruling, calling it a blatant aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem says the ruling is another attempt to divide the holy site that's in violation of all international law and norms. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has also slammed the decision as invalid. On Wednesday, an Israeli judge in the occupied Al-Quds ruled that Israelis' silent prayers at the Al-Aqsa could not be considered as a criminal act.
On Wednesday, Israeli judge ruled that silent prayer of the Israeli Jews at the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque cannot be considered a ruled act and is now allowed. This comes because there was an appeal by Israeli Jewish Rabbi Ari Aleppo against Israeli police ban that were not allowing him to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and to pray there. We have to make it clear that Israeli settlers raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound frequently. However, they are not allowed to pray there because the compound houses the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Clashes continue to take place. Of course, Palestinians are demanding international position because allowing the Israeli settlers to raid the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound is illegal. However, now while allowing the settlers to pray there, then Palestinians are in need for action, not only condemnations from the international community or the European Union. Palestinians are hoping that the EU and the international community would be forcing the Israeli regime not to allow this new policy to take place.
Russia says NATO's latest actions against it will have an adverse effect on the alliance's ties with Moscow.
There is a glaring discrepancy between NATO officials' statements about their wish to normalize relations with our country and real actions. These actions, of course, leave no room for illusions regarding the normalization of relations and the resumption of the dialogue with NATO. These prospects are rather completely upset.
The Kremlin spokesman made a comment today after NATO expelled 8 Russian diplomats, accusing them of being undeclared intelligence officers. The alliance also halved the size of the Russian mission, accusing Moscow of increased malign activities against NATO members. Russia has repeatedly denied such allegations made by the Western alliance. Reacting to NATO's latest moves, a senior Russian lawmaker said that Moscow will retaliate, but not necessarily in kind. Based on a UN report, the Security Council's sanctions against North Korea have worsened the country's humanitarian situation.
Sanctions imposed by the UN Security Council should be reviewed and eased when necessary to both facilitate humanitarian and life-saving assistance and to enable the promotion to the right to an adequate standard of living of ordinary citizens.
The UN rights investigator says the risk of starvation threatens the country's access to food has become a serious concern. He added the impact of sanctions has also left the country short of essential medical supplies while increasing prices by several fold. In June, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said that the food situation was tense because of natural disasters, acknowledging that his people faced difficulties during the pandemic. Now, when it comes to social media giant Facebook and its offshoots, there are many arguments for and against as to how they are being operated and benefited. A Facebook whistleblower, however, has come forward and heavily criticized it. While testifying in Capitol Hill, she accused Facebook of harming children, sowing division and undermining democracy in pursuit of breakneck growth and astronomical profits.
U.S. social media giant has come under scathing attack by a former employee. The company has been accused of putting profit over everything else. Former Facebook employee Frances Hogan says that the company's sites and apps are harmful for children. She's also accused the social media platform of stoking divisions in society. 37-year-old Hogan was previously a product manager at the company. Now she's a whistleblower and has turned against Facebook. She made the accusation at a hearing in the Senate. Hogan accused Facebook of putting profit over safety and compared it to tobacco companies, arguing that a company with such frightening influence over so many people, over their deepest thoughts, feelings, and behavior, needs real oversight. She also said that if left alone, Facebook will continue to make choices that go against the common good.
If you look at the way that they filter content, if you look at the way that they censor certain topics that they'd rather not be seen, the way that they quote-unquote fact-check some of the things, the way that they delete accounts without discretion, the way that they censor people, and the way that they choose what content goes at the top of your newsfeed or shows up on your newsfeed at all through their algorithm, they really have a grip on what it is we are able to see on Facebook.
The context for the hearing were materials that she had leaked to the Wall Street Journal. According to the documents, Facebook's own studies suggest that Instagram and social media in general have a negative psychological effect on young girls. She also accused Facebook's CEO Zuckerberg of having too much power and bringing up the January 6th Capitol riot.
Facebook wants you to believe that the problems we're talking about are unsolvable. They want you to believe in false choices. They want you to believe that you must choose between a Facebook full of divisive and extreme content or losing one of the most important values our country was founded upon, free speech. That you must choose between public oversight of Facebook's choices and your personal privacy. That to be able to share fun photos of your kids with old friends, you must also be inundated with anger-driven virality. They want you to believe that this is just part of the deal.
Now, according to the whistleblower's testimony, Facebook consistently chose to maximize its growth rather than implement safeguards on its platforms. citing more division, more harm, more lies, more threats, and more combat. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, however, hit back, saying that her claims are illogical and simply not true.
Facebook has faced growing scrutiny and increasing calls for its regulation. Founder Mark Zuckerberg hit back, saying the latest accusations were at odds with the company's goals. In a letter to the staff, he said that many of the claims were illogical and pointed to Facebook's efforts to fight harmful content. The CEO argued that while Facebook took the initiative to create a massive research project to identify and solve certain problems, critics are merely weaponizing that work against the company to create a false narrative. Responding to Hogan's claims that Facebook's attempts to limit harmful content were constantly hampered by a shortage of staff, he said, "If we did not care about fighting harmful content, then why would we employ so many more people dedicated to this than any other company in our space, even ones larger than us?" Facebook is the world's most popular social media site. The company says it has 2.7 billion monthly active users.
So I think overall it's very detrimental to democracy because of the flow of information that is so tightly controlled through Facebook. And also think it shows, much like tobacco companies in the past or vape companies, that they've targeted children who are in very crucial developmental stages in their lives in order to get new customers, as noted in the testimony before the Senate.
Hundreds of millions of people also use the company's other products, including WhatsApp and Instagram, but it has been criticized on several fronts, from failing to protect users' privacy to not doing enough to halt the spread of disinformation.
Facebook, as I said, can truly decide what shows up in your newsfeed, what gets attention, what is put in the spotlight, and what is suppressed. And I think that's a big problem. It doesn't matter who you're friends with or who you like or the groups you're in, etc. They can filter stuff out through including certain ads. They can bury stuff in their algorithms. They can ban or censor or suspend accounts that may or may not go against the terms of service. Sometimes it's not so clear whether or not certain users go against terms of service, but find themselves banned or suspended anyway.
The accusations against the social media giant came amid a worldwide outage of the company's platforms. The social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. The global outage and the revelations seriously harmed the media giant's status in the world as a reliable media platform.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
People who receive two COVID-19 jabs and later contract the Delta variant are less likely to infect their close contacts than are unvaccinated people with Delta. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Smriti Malapati, researcher. This article is published under the heading, COVID vaccines cut risk of transmitting Delta, but not for long. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The first study to look directly at how well vaccines prevent the spread of the Delta variant of SARS-CoV-2 brings good news and bad. The study shows that people who become infected with the Delta variant are less likely to pass the virus to their close contacts if they have already had a COVID-19 vaccine than if they haven't. But that protective effect is relatively small and dwindles alarmingly at 3 months after the receipt of the second shot. The findings add to scientists' understanding of the vaccination's effect on curbing Delta's spread, but are both more and less encouraging, says Marm Kalprick, an infectious disease researcher at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Previous studies have found that people infected with Delta have roughly the same levels of viral genetic materials in their noses, regardless of whether they had previously been vaccinated, suggesting that vaccinated and unvaccinated people might be equally infectious. But studies also suggest that vaccinated people are less likely to spread the virus if they subsequently catch Delta. The levels of nasal virus drop faster than those of unvaccinated infected people, and their nasal swabs contain smaller amounts of infectious virus. The latest study examined the effect of vaccines on transmission more directly. It analyzed testing data from 139,164 close contacts of 91,716 people infected with SARS-CoV-2 between January and August 2021 in the UK, when the Alpha and Delta variants were competing for dominance. The authors found that although the vaccines did offer some protection against infection and onward transmission, Delta dampened that effect. A person who was fully vaccinated and then had a breakthrough Delta infection was almost twice as likely to pass on the virus as someone who was infected with Alpha. And that was on top of the higher risk of having a breakthrough infection caused by Delta than one caused by Alpha. Unfortunately, the vaccine's beneficial effect on Delta transmission waned to almost negligible levels over time. In people infected 2 weeks after receiving the vaccine developed by a pharmaceutical company both in the UK, the chance that an unvaccinated close contact would test positive was 57%, but 3 months later that chance rose to 67%. The latter figure is on par with the likelihood of an unvaccinated person will spread the virus. A reduction was also observed in people vaccinated with the jab. The risk of spreading the Delta infection soon after vaccination with that jab was 42%, but increased to 58% with time. there is a step change with Alpha versus Delta, but then there is also a change over time, says co-author David Eyre, an epidemiologist at the University of Oxford, UK. The results possibly explain why we have seen so much onward transmission of Delta, despite widespread vaccination. But the results also offer the intriguing possibility that if you do run a booster campaign because you want to protect individuals, it may also have this effect of reducing transmission, says Eyre. Booster campaigns raise a new uncertainty, says Stephen Riley, an infectious disease researcher at Imperial College London. Whether the same waning of protection from infectiousness will occur after the third dose. The study has not yet been peer-reviewed.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing Warriors from the North, directed by Nasib Farah and Sorenstein Jespersen. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Masoud Shajareh, who is the Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Now, Warriors from the North is a complex and multi-layered narrative that gives you a chilling insight into what fuels the current trend of Western Muslim youth leaving the West to join radical extremist groups abroad, such as Al-Shabaab, which is an Al-Qaeda-linked militant group in Somalia. The documentary tells the story of a Danish-Somalian boy in Copenhagen who fell victim to Al-Shabaab recruiters.
We were young men in our early 20s. We missed action. I was very attracted by being able to do something and stop being just one of them who's looked down on, you know. And now Mohammed's in Somalia, He's a warrior for Al-Shabaab. His father, Abukar, is afraid that his son will also become a suicide bomber.
I joined Al-Shabaab because I had nothing else to do or nothing left for it but to join.
We were a true group. We felt that Al-Shabaab showed us respect. I'd never experienced respect like that before.
And first of all, welcome both of you to the show. And Rich, as our guest film critic, what was your take on Warriors from the North?
Well, it's really, really well made, and it's got that kind of Danish filmmaking sheen to it. Beautifully shot, very clever use of archival footage and stills, and I mean, they make a lot of use of videotape that they get of these warriors, mm-hmm. kind of
so-called
really
warriors.
Chilling, yeah. really chilling videotapes. And but then there's also a lot of footage shot in Copenhagen that's very beautifully shot, very cleverly put together. It's only an hour long. It's a short documentary, so it's not really a kind of comprehensive look at the situation. It's a very specific story about these specific people and in their situation, even though it does have references to the larger story.
And for our viewers who haven't seen the film, in a nutshell, could you just briefly describe what it's about?
Basically, it centers on this man who calls himself the Shadow because he doesn't want to be identified. So you only see him as a shadow on screen, just his silhouette. And he tells his story about being a disaffected youth, basically had a bad breakup and tries to recover by partying and getting drunk. And of course, his family doesn't approve of that, so he doesn't really have his family around him. And he's on his own, and he makes all these friends who take him into this closed circle and kind of groom him to go to Somalia, which is where he's from originally, but he hasn't been back there since he was a child. Mm-hmm. So and he tells the story quite coherently. You understand why he fell into this group. He loves the camaraderie of these other men, and then that group dissolved. But some of the men went to mm-hmm. Somalia.
And we'll actually touch more on that.
And that's where where the film veers. It follows one of his friends who has disappeared in Somalia, and the friend's father is trying to find him there. So you get that parallel story of the mm-hmm. father trying to find his son.
Pretty much, essentially, that's what happens. We don't want to give too much away, but Masoud, I'd like your take on the documentary. As someone who works on tackling Islamophobia, did you have the same take as Rich?
No, I think the film didn't go out to be Islamophobic. I mean, I actually think it was quite clear that. But I think the environment and the way that the whole thing is within our society, it really came out that way because, you know, I, as the film was about the franchise sort of youth getting involved and doing something which is unsavory, you know, say the least. But that happens to a lot of our youth, both Muslim and non-Muslim. And it really didn't tackle that, you know, that aspect. It's sort of what is sort of tackled is that here Islam, you know, it's give the perception that here was an Islam violent sort of thing, an output for them to go and do this. And you know, the shots, for example, sort of having discussion in the mosque or having sort of discussion outside the shop with Arabic writing in the back and so forth, it really created that association. Mm-hmm. While in reality, the other side of the story was saying, really, this is not the case. This is just a bunch of youth who are really lost. You
so
know.
You're saying there's multiple messages in this film.
It is, but I think that message was mixed up with some other messages which were sort of visual messages and which is conflicting one another.
Well, that's a really good point, and I'd like to take a brief break now from the discussion. Rich, what did you make of this story and his struggle to bring back his son?
It's quite a wrenching story because he's really worried about his son. He knows that the life of one of these kids who goes to Somalia tends to last about 1 or 2 years before they're involved in some sort of bombing, which is just horrible to think about, for a father to think about his son being taken off there. He doesn't understand why his son even fell into this group. It's pretty wrenching. It's very intense. And also, the Shadow, the other character, who was a good friend of Muhammad, so is talking about his friend who's just gone, and he doesn't know what's happened to him.
And I think one of the interesting points about this father figure, who probably represents the voice of all the parents struggling to bring back their children who are lost to extremist groups is that the father is nothing like his son. And I think many people might be surprised to see that, that usually the idea is that the children become radicalized by their parents. But this isn't the case, is it, Masood?
No, I think this is what where I think the documentary failed. Although it was giving messages that strengthened that, but it failed to actually say that, you know, this conveyor belt sort of that is sort of usually talked by British government and other governments, that, you know, people start one side and then eventually they become radicalized at the end, which is being disputed by all academics and indeed by intelligence services, but it still is being pushed as a basis of our anti-terrorism sort of strategy. It's not factual, it's actually false. And, you know, this guy, if anything, was quite a misguided group of people, very alienated, all of them. And out of boredom and alienation of where they were actually dragged into that arena. And this was, it was a fact, but wasn't really strengthened.
But this documentary surely is about the personal stories of the individuals, not so much addressing the politics of the situation.
No, but you see, it's very difficult not to, you know, because at the end of the day, that is what makes this very moving. And you know, for example, many of other youth in our society, they might not be Muslim, they might go and join a gang, and they actually end up going as much wrong as these guys gone. And that is something...
Or they get into a right-wing group that commits atrocities at home.
Atrocities at home. I mean, this is, you know, is a really a challenge for our society to, first of all, to understand this phenomenon, and then to address it, if possible. And this is sort of... did not actually reach that. Look, these youth, although they got involved in this thing, but they were no different to other youth in the society who gets misguided and out of boredom and of nothing to do, and of the fact that, you know, I mean, he was saying, they were saying that that was a group of them coming together, it was a family for them. So there was something really lacking in the society.
Rich, would you agree with Masood, what he's saying there, that this documentary should have given more context to what's happening?
I mean, I think since it's just a one-hour documentary, it's very short, and I think they were specifically trying to tell this one story. But they do bring in stories from other people. They have the one, there's the extensive video clips of the boy who went from the UK to Somalia, and then he got out of Al-Shabaab. And I wish they had replaced that story with another story of someone in Denmark who found the family in his mosque and didn't, you know, and found what he was missing, you know.
That's
and I thought that was what was missing in the film, was the story of someone who found the positive side of Islam, the peaceful side, and, you know, and didn't succumb to violence, which isn't really part of Islam.
Well,
and the film does make that clear. It makes it clear that this violence and these kind of, you know, bombers are not actually Islamic. That's not part of Islam.
I think that's a really important point, that you make that point. And I'm afraid we'll just have to pause it just for now.
Look at the vulnerable young teenagers who have problems with their families, who have problems with the government, who have issues with police, who are an easy target for Al-Shabaab, because the person's mind is already crafted and polluted. You know, in his own mind, he doesn't trust the police, because the police are the ones that are locking him up and putting him in jail. He doesn't really trust his family, because his family doesn't give him enough support. So what does he do? He comes forward, like him. He joins Al-Shabaab, ends up being killed himself.
You really get a sense of how alienated and isolated these young Somalis feel in Denmark. Rich, do you think this documentary was successful in outlining the reasons why these young Danish Somalis go and fight for Al-Shabaab?
It kind of hints at the situation in Europe, where young Somali teenagers are treated like outsiders, so they don't feel like they belong in the society where they've grown up. And these young men have grown up in Denmark, but they don't feel Danish. And they don't really feel Somalian either, because they never lived there, really. So they feel like they don't have any home. And it does really convey that idea. I don't know what, you know, the what's the answer to that. We need to have more open societies that accept people, and maybe the trick is to target prejudice and these ideas that the general public have that marginalize groups of people. But that happens on every level of society, not just ethnically. And
yeah, no, of course. I saw you nodding your head there, Masood. Would you agree with what Rich just said?
Yes, I think, I mean, our society is much more complicated than one issue results in one thing. You know, really, it's not as simple as that. Alienation is one aspect. And the other aspect is that these are the youth who, some of them came across the way that they were being interviewed. They were concerned about injustices around the world. And they wanted to do something about it, which is a very amicable thing to feeling to have. But instead of that feeling being strengthened and supported in the right way of addressing those things, the only thing they could find was actually going and being recruited by these guys. And that is actually a failure that I see in our society day in, day out. And indeed, the government policies and so forth exaggerate this. And the reality is that there are forcing us not to be political, not to address these issues, not to talk. The elephant in the room is being ignored. And the reality is that these youth, and indeed the other youth, are not given the right tools to be, activists in a real sense for the right thing, for the right reason, and with the right tools. And if you remove that from any youth, you're actually leaving open very negative aspect to sneak in, because youth want to do something. They want to be part of a solution. And I think we're failing them in that way. And the other aspect is that we are giving wrong messages as a society. We actually tell, through our policies overseas and things, we're actually giving message that end justifies the means. And that message ultimately is a terrorist justification. And if we give that message could be interpreted and used in other arenas, and people go towards these sort of extreme ways of addressing something which is very, very noble.
And Rich, I get the sense from this documentary that the filmmakers are trying to, while not necessarily directly sympathize with the recruits, but at the same time they're condemning and showing how horrific their crimes are. Are you getting that sense that the recruits are victims in their own right as well?
Yeah, the film clearly presents them as victims. It presents them as good children who have been brainwashed and kind of convinced that this is the way that they should act and mm-hmm. what they should do. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a sense that it's presenting them as it's not their fault. They're 16-year-olds who have been convinced that what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it does. I mean, our discussion is going way beyond the material in the film, because it is a short film and it is very concentrated on this very specific
story. And that's
story.
A merit to the film, because it raises many serious questions.
It causes you to think about these things that it doesn't really address, and that's quite important.
And we're going to talk about sort of the vulnerability issue of these recruits.
At one time, I was very seductive too during this thing. I sort of believed in it for a moment, and I was ready at one time in my life.
I used to think that killing is okay, that, wrapping yourself up with suicide bomb, exploding yourself in the midst of 10,000 people or something was okay. Until I got to a certain level, and I saw that it was wrong, endless, non-stop killing for no reason. When I saw more civilians dying than actual soldiers here in Somalia, that's when I stopped being Al-Shabaab. I wish there's something I can do to stop from all these other kids from getting fooled by the same way I got fooled, being tricked into just endless killing. I want to change.
So it's Mohammed Ali Omar there in that clip, and he's in hiding in Somalia but wishes to return to Europe. And Rich, are there many options for people like him if they wish to return? Because I think he fears of being prosecuted.
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know what the legal situation for someone like that is. I don't know if he would be. I don't know what he's done. Has he
but
done anything illegal?
In the film, does it show that path at all?
Yeah, and it doesn't. The film doesn't really go into that. I found myself wishing that was a separate documentary about him, because I think his story is quite interesting and it's more hopeful because it does have a. well, I mean, it's not finished yet because he is in hiding. But it's a fascinating story to me, and I think, you know, I'm hoping some documentary filmmaker watches this and thinks, and goes and finds him and tells his story,
and maybe helps him
reintegrate into European society.
Mm-hmm. And Monsieur, following from that clip, how is it that young people, and you talked about it earlier, how this film doesn't explain why they're being tricked or how. Could you help explain why and how they're being tricked into mosques and joining in extremist groups?
Well, really, it's difficult to say exactly how it's happening, but as I said, there are a number of issues.
Is it that they're taking a literalist interpretation of Islam, perhaps Wahhabism?
Well, what we know that, and this film touches on that, that actually the most ignorant of Islam youth are the ones who actually get recruited. One recruit from Britain, he actually ordered Islam for Dummies, you know, just before going. So this is not something that is motivated by Islam, but unfortunately our way of combating it is all geared towards we got to find out this Islam and change it. And unfortunately one thing which I really felt it was wrong in the film, it gives two alternatives, one for the youth to go and be a terrorist, and the other one was actually going to club. And the third option wasn't there. I mean, you didn't look at hundreds and thousands of youth who are Muslim, who are practicing Muslim, who are great contributors. And this stereotyping, unfortunately, is very damaging. I think also the reality is that, you know, on one side, the end justifies mean policy, which West has been pursuing, is the problem. And the other thing is actually, we have got involved from the West with the Saudi regime in creating a new version of Islam for our political sort of needs in the Middle East region. And this has backfired. It backfired in Afghanistan, it's backfiring now, it's backfiring in Syria. And out of that, it actually comes these sort of horrifying ideology of killing everyone, and which it's now interpreted that these are Muslims killing non-Muslims, but the reality is that groups like Daesh are killing more Muslims than non-Muslim, but they're killing everyone and justifying it by Islam, which was social engineered as a foreign policy with the help of our Saudi partners.
Well, that is definitely way outside of the film, but thank you for the explanation. But I think the filmmakers in this documentary are saying it's easy to write off these groups of people, but I think they want to make viewers think that what role do the West play in radicalizing these individuals? Is that one of the messages?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is that message about why are these kids just left to fall through the cracks of their society? Why is their only option to either become radicalized or go out clubbing and getting drunk? Why are they left like that? It doesn't really examine that. It kind of raises the issue to think about, and I kind of wish it had. But then, that's another film. So.
Mm-hmm. And final thoughts for 30 seconds to you, Masood. Would you recommend that people see this film? I know it's only an hour long, and it raises many questions. But as a starting point, perhaps.
I do, but I say again, you know, some of the visuals conflicted with the messages it was given. So you know, different people could watch it and come up with different things. I could imagine very clearly some Islamophobes and extreme right will see it, and it will be justification for all their visions.
So it's open to interpretation,
sure,
I guess.
I'm not sure about that. It does come out fairly strongly about immoral the actions of these suicide bombings are.
I'm sorry, gentlemen, we'll have to leave it there, but we could keep talking all day. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thanks for tuning in. I've been Camila Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.